Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we look at the American Revolution, for once, from the side of the British, through the eyes of a British historian who's written a very interesting book called An Empire on the Edge. In part two of today's program, we'll remember a great American from that period, Benjamin Franklin. Stay with us. I am very excited about the opportunity to speak with a very, very highly admired author and historian by the name of Nick Bunker, who is responsible for a number of fascinating books, including Making Haste from Babylon, which is one of the best books ever written about the Mayflower and the first years of the Plymouth Colony. His newest book is called An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America. And in it, we have the perspective from the Brits of just what exactly led to the fighting of the Revolutionary War. And that is a story which we Americans almost exclusively think about and view through the prism of our own understanding and perspective as Americans. And Mr. Bunker is a very dispassionate and unbiased observer of history in a sense, and yet also brings to the table a British perspective, which is so helpful in understanding just what brought the American Revolution about. And so much of it is about Britain and its all but unmanageable empire at the time, and in particular their difficulty and maybe even incompetence when it came to overseeing the vast reach of the North American continent. It's a fascinating story, and this book, now available in paperback from Vintage, a division of Random House, is again called An Empire on the Edge, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Nick Bunker, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Hello.
I'm so excited to be talking with you. Briefly, I wonder if you would share with our listeners a story which I saw you share in some sort of interview about what prompted your own interest in America. And I believe you credit that in a sense to having read some National Geographic issues a long time ago. Just say it's an interesting story. Tell our listeners briefly about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's, when I was a very small boy in England, when I used to be taking my mother to the dentist, the dentist surgery was always piled high with old copies of the National Geographic. And this was the 60s, mid-60s, and what he had was a number of copies of National Geographic which dealt with the centennial of the Civil War. And so I would sit there reading these magazines, absolutely fascinated by all these stories about Stonewall Jackson and the various battles, Gettysburg and so forth. And so that really, when I was a small boy, was what prompted my interest in American history. And then, of course, as I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, our television screens were always filled every evening with dramatic events from the United States, whether it be the space program or the Vietnam War, or later, of course, Watergate, which was absolutely fascinating. So really, my interest in American history does go back to that era.
Well, I'm glad it did, because, of course, your book about the Mayflower is so highly regarded, and this latest book is especially fascinating. I think one of the places we should examine with some detail is the state of the British Empire at this point in time, in these years right before the Revolutionary War was fought. At one point in the book, you describe it as an odd and fragile empire that no one had designed and very few people could claim to understand. Explain a little further the way in which the British Empire at this point in time in particular was an odd and fragile empire.
Well, it originated, you see, as a kind of privatized empire back in the 17th century. The Crown of England, although it had been quite keen to see colonies and plantations, both in Ireland but also in America and in the West Indies, never really had the resources to be able to undertake the work of plantation and colonization itself, so that it was kind of farmed out and subcontracted to private enterprise. And the empire, therefore, had a kind of unplanned, slightly kind of inchoate kind of feel to it throughout its first century or so of existence. Now, from time to time, the British would try to introduce a bit of regularity. They would try to introduce some tighter control from the centre. And they did this, for example, in the 1680s. And again, they started trying to do it from about the 1740s. But the difficulty was really twofold. First of all, that the British didn't really want to spend money on administration of their empire. They didn't really want to spend resources. And also, they tended to become distracted by other events. At the end of the day, what was going on in Europe, what was going on in the kind of the diplomatic situation in Europe and the machinations of the French and the Prussians and the Austrians and so on, tended to loom far more heavily in their minds than events 3,000 miles away and across the other side of the Atlantic.
Hmm. At one point you say that part of the problem here was that North America was a continent which she, meaning Britain, did not comprehend and could not hope to rule. And they never had any kind of solid plan for administering the American colonies. I'm just curious, how true was that for other parts of the British Empire? I mean, was it equally true or was it exceptionally true that North America was, in a sense, this incomprehensible place that the Brits just did not really begin to understand and didn't bother to come to a better understanding of it until it was too late?
Well, if you take the various other elements of the British Empire, really there were two others. The West Indies, the British West Indies, essentially Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, and so on, and also, of course, the new empire in India and the Far East. Now, the part of the British Empire that was most understood and that was most heavily under control were the sugar colonies in the West Indies. But that, of course, was because though they were relatively small in terms of population and size, they were also exceptionally valuable. Now, the Indian situation was a different one out in Bengal, centered on Calcutta. The situation there was that the British had, in the course of about 20 years prior to the American Revolutionary War, they had managed to acquire this enormous territorial empire, which they hadn't initially expected to do. They had simply been beneficiaries of what was effectively the breakup of the Mughal Empire at that time. So they had found themselves in possession of this vast territory, including what is now the whole of the modern nation of Bangladesh, the whole of the Indian states of West Bengal and Bihar. This is a vast, vast area. And again, you see, it took many, many years. It took perhaps 30, 40 years or so before the British actually worked out a viable way of controlling those territories. It took them until actually into the 19th century. So America wasn't exceptional. The other difficulty in America was, of course, that America effectively did have its own government, or rather it had 13 governments of its own, because each of the colonies had its own little parliament or colonial assembly. And, of course, they really, by the time of the 1770s, were effectively the government for all intents and purposes in those areas.
More so than Britain's government.
Well, yes, really. I mean, most of the day-to-day work of government was actually being done by Americans themselves, particularly in Massachusetts and Rhode Island in New England, where effectively the colonists were running their own affairs on a town and county basis, so they were used to a kind of habit of autonomy. And the problem really in 1774-5 was that the British, in response to the Boston Tea Party, suddenly tried to take this autonomy of New England away. Well, that was obviously something that was going to lead to severe problems.
It sounds like one of the most serious mistakes which Great Britain made was the way in which they viewed North America. And by the way, I would also be curious to know if, again, this was exceptionally true about North America or if this was equally true of other parts of their empire, but saw it almost entirely in terms of commerce. In fact, at one point, I think you talk about how Britain had, in effect, two overlapping empires, political and commercial, and they were almost completely preoccupied with the commercial aspect and neglected the other, which was a big reason why the situation turned as troubled as it did.
Yes, I mean, in this I actually differ from some other British historians currently. I mean, in the last 20 years or so, there have been a number of British historians who have argued that the British actually did have quite a comprehensive imperial ideology and that they were saw themselves as very much a British empire, Protestant and et cetera. Now, my view is probably a slightly more traditional one, which is that actually, essentially, it was simply a money-making enterprise. The British weren't really terribly ideological at this period. They weren't really terribly interested in abstract ideas about politics and so on. What they were basically interested in doing was simply having an empire that generated large amounts of wealth for the mother country by way of the flow of tobacco and sugar and so forth back across the North Atlantic and the export of manufactured goods to Americans who couldn't make manufactured goods of their own. So I do see it very much as a commercial empire. And also, the British Empire at the time, in its commercial aspect, was also speculative. Basically, what it was doing was to engage in a lot of speculative trading in commodities, the ones I mentioned, sugar, tobacco, tea coming back from China. And therefore, it was also an empire that was heavily financed by debt, both private sector debt as well as public sector debt, that is to say, debt from private individuals as well as debts owed by the state. And that, of course, again, meant that it was kind of inherently fragile and unstable. You know, sooner or later, there was going to be a situation where a financial or a commercial crisis coincided with a political crisis, and that's essentially what happened in the 1770s. And the British government simply couldn't cope. They didn't really have any way to think through the problems they were dealing with, and they didn't really have any administrative mechanism to sort out the various problems that arose.
Hmm. How significant was the banking crash, which I believe occurred in 1772, and what were the most important ramifications for that in terms of this period and this situation which your book examines?
Well, it was very severe. I mean, in the 18th century, there were two great financial crises. One was the South Sea Bubble in the early 1720s, and the other one was the crash of 1772, and it came about for the classic reasons. There had been a great big boom in speculation in real estate and commodities and so on, and suddenly it all went horribly wrong in the middle of 1772 when an investment bank in London collapsed. Now, the problem with it was that it caused all sorts of difficulties. It very nearly led to the financial collapse of the East India Company, the body which had all the tea, which ended up in Boston Harbor. It also had knock-on effects in the colonies, too, particularly in Virginia, where many of the colonists, many of the tobacco planters of Virginia, relied very heavily on borrowings that they contracted, in particularly in Scotland. And there was a period of about a year or so when the flow of credit for the tobacco planters of Virginia just dried up totally. And what that meant was that the Virginians began to become more and more disenchanted, so to speak, with the capabilities of the British Empire. I mean, the whole point of the empire really was that it was supposed to enrich everybody on both sides of the Atlantic. And in the 1770s, it was beginning to look as though that just wasn't happening.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Nick Bunker. And he is a British historian responsible for a number of fine books, the latest of which is called An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America, a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It's a fascinating examination of the state of affairs, which in effect led to the American Revolution. But it is a story told through the eyes of Britain by this British historian. Review of your book described it as one of the only books really well written on the fascinating topic of the mechanics of ruling from afar. I love that phrase, and I quite agree with that reviewer that I think this is one of the most interesting things about this story and about your book. Remind us of just the nearly insurmountable challenges that were involved in that time and place to try to rule from afar, and to what extent it could have been done more effectively had, in a sense, different people been in charge or maybe thought in some innovative ways. I mean, how possible would it have been for Britain to effectively govern the North American continent at that point in time?
Well, the obvious problem is that the most obvious one is the fact of time and distance, that it took so long for messages to pass back and forth to the Atlantic. But it's important not to overemphasize that, because that had been an issue for a very long time, and there were ways of getting around it. The most logical thing for the British to have done, really, would have been to place a viceroy in New York. They would have had to appoint an official, a high-ranking British official, someone with a lot of talent and a lot of experience, to go over to America and become effectively the viceroy of the colonies overall. That is to say, the king's representative, because then he would have been able to react quickly to developments in the colonies when he saw signs of trouble or signs of issues that needed tackling. And he also would have been able to develop an intelligence network. One of the difficulties the British had was that they were dependent on, for information, very largely on the individual governors of each of the 13 colonies. Now, those 13 governors varied significantly in terms of their talents and in terms of their attitude and in terms of their readiness to actually do some work. Some of them were very diligent, hardworking. Some of them were completely the reverse and rarely sent dispatches back to London. So often there was this kind of great big gap. And the problem of the quality of the colonial governors was really probably one of the three or four top problems that the British faced at the time.
I appreciate the great detail that you with which you describe two of the most important men on the British side in this period, the Prime Minister, Lord North, and then Lord Dartmouth, which in a sense was responsible for the colonies themselves. You describe them in terms that make them sound like, in many ways, quite admirable men, and yet in crucial ways, not quite equal to the task that was set before them.
Well, that's right. Now, these two men, Frederick North was the Prime Minister. Lord Dartmouth, actually, his stepbrother, actually, was the colonial secretary. Now, both men in their mid-40s, both highly educated. They'd both been to the same Oxford College, both adept in Latin and Greek and so on. And also, from a private moral point of view, actually, they were paragons of virtue. Both of them were devoted family men. Lord Dartmouth, in particular, was a devout evangelical Christian. He was famous for it at a time when the aristocracy tended not to be the least bit pious, and he was also an early advocate of the abolition of the slave trade. So, and also, Lord Dartmouth, Lord North in particular, was very hardworking. Lord North was constantly attending debates in Parliament, speaking many hundreds of times during his career, and also something of a master of finance. So they had all kinds of qualities, and they were actually men of integrity by the standards of their time. But the difficulty was really, well, there were several difficulties. One of the problems with Lord North was, first of all, he tended to panic. In a crisis, especially a foreign policy crisis, he would be inclined to take decisions that were too hasty. And he would end up committing himself to a course of action that later he would regret. And that's really what happened after the news of the Tea Party riot in 1774. The British government rushed to take decisions within a matter of weeks when it might have been better to delay for a while, and in particular to gather more intelligence from the other colonies just besides Massachusetts. The other problem with Lord North was that he was immensely loyal to his king, to George III. And once George III had taken the view in 1774 that steps needed to be taken to bring Massachusetts securely back within the fold, then there was really no way that Lord North was going to disagree with the king or to take any independent line. And Lord Dartmouth, on the other hand, well, Dartmouth, as I say, was a very pious evangelical Christian, but he had a kind of a streak of authoritarianism in him. And when he eventually reached the conclusion that the colonists were in rebellion, which was the legal advice he received from the government's law offices, once he'd made that decision that the colonists were in rebellion, then in effect he had to commit himself to a policy of fairly stern retribution.
Your book, of course, chronicles in fascinating detail the Boston Tea Party and helps us understand why that phase of the rebellion took place. And I think probably your background as a former investment banker, you know, equips you to understand sort of the economic complexities of that situation better than maybe some other historians. You probably spend even more time with a much less discussed event. I mean, that is, it's prominently discussed by you, but often Americans don't remember the so-called Gaspé affair, which I think occurred about a year before. Briefly, tell our listeners about this and its significance.
Well, that was in June 1772, and with the Gaspé incident, it's very big in Rhode Island, because that's where it happened. The people of Rhode Island certainly remember it. What happened was that the mariners and merchants of Providence, Rhode Island, destroyed a Royal Navy warship in the Providence River, a warship named the Gaspé, which was there to patrol the coast to clamp down on the smuggling trade. And the people of Providence were heavily involved in contraband, and so they destroyed this Royal Navy warship. Now, the reason this is important is really, really twofold. Firstly, because, of course, in London, when the news arrived in Whitehall with Lord North and his colleagues, of course, they were horrified. And it helped to harden their attitude substantially. It meant, really, from that moment forth, there was going to be a significant body of opinion within the British government which regarded the Americans as either rebels already or potential rebels. The other reason it was important was because the British didn't respond to it very cleverly. They kind of dithered. They knew they were very angry about it, but they couldn't think of any mechanism with which to respond. And the mechanism they came up with, trying to catch the perpetrators from Providence, was doomed to failure. It was doomed to failure because, of course, nobody in Providence would get up in court and testify against the men responsible. And so, therefore, all the British did by responding in that way was simply to antagonize people even more in Rhode Island and New England without actually achieving anything. And then that, in due course, also helped to feed into the anger and bitterness in Massachusetts that led to the Tea Party.
Hmm. At one point in the book, you say that the war had been long in the making, the product of an empire and a system deeply flawed, the work of ignorance and prejudice, and of men well-meaning, but the prisoners of ideas that were obsolete and empty. I suppose those are cautionary words for just about anybody in any era, that we need to make sure that as we tackle the most pressing problems and issues and challenges of the day, that we aren't doing so in a sense shackled to ideas that have already run their course and aren't equal to the challenge of the moment.
Well, indeed. I mean, those lines you quote are actually in the closing lines of the book. And what you have to be careful of when you make statements like that in a book as a historian is that you're not simply judging with the benefit of 230 years of hindsight. It's important, if one's going to say a thing like that, as I do, that there were people at the time who felt the same way. And indeed, there were. I think the closing paragraph that you're quoted there also includes a quotation from one of them, a man called the Duke of Richmond. Now, the book doesn't really have any heroes, but my favorite character, perhaps, is the Duke of Richmond, Charles Lennox, the Duke of Richmond. He was a member of the British aristocracy. He was an extremely wealthy man, but he was also very outspoken, and he was by far the most outspoken critic on the British side of the government's response. By far the most vocal supporter of the American cause. As I say, he's my favorite character. But it's very important that one can, if one's going to make those kind of statements that you just quoted me making there, that they have some connection with what was actually said at the time, as well as simply being the with hindsight wisdom of someone living two centuries later.
So he says you cannot force a form of government upon a people.
That's right.
And of course, those words prove to be very, very true in this instance. The book, again, is An Empire on the Edge, How Britain Came to Fight America, a vintage book, a division of Random House, now available in paperback, and the author, Nick Bunker. Nick Bunker, a pleasure and honor for me to speak to you today about your fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Greg.
And the time is 8:32. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program, an interview from the archives. For the next few minutes, you are going to be hearing from Mr. Benjamin Franklin. Well, sort of, anyway. We're actually going to be speaking with author Tom Blair, who in his book, Poorer Richard's America, What Would Ben Say?, offers some thoughts about the current state of affairs in our country and seeks to do so in the voice of Benjamin Franklin, or at least to some extent. It's actually not the easiest thing to explain, and one almost needs to just take the book in hand to really understand what I am talking about. But in this book, Tom Blair, with remarkable skill, manages to adopt sort of the cadence and personality and rhythm of Benjamin Franklin. And just as he took such a discerning, disarming sort of view of his own world back in the mid-18th century, so he seems to do so again in the pages of this most intriguing book. Tom Blair has been a very, very successful businessman, has lived in Washington for a long, long time, as far as I can tell, not a politician himself, but certainly one who has observed the political world up close for many, many years. and evidently has a great admiration for and affection for Benjamin Franklin and what he had to say about American life and Americans. This really intriguing book is published by Skyhorse Publishing, and it includes generous excerpts from the actual writing of Benjamin Franklin himself. The book, again, is called Poorer Richard's America, What Would Ben Say? And Tom Blair, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Greg.
Looking forward to it. I assume that I am right in that you have great affection and admiration for Benjamin Franklin. I can't imagine that you would write such a book if you didn't.
I must say, I started off with great admiration, but as I did more and more research, I became in absolute awe of the man. I think many people in America are skewed by the notion of Ben Franklin helped Thomas Jefferson with the Declaration of Independence and did the thing with the kite. And I think almost the kite and his work as a scientist diluted some of the other things that he did. The reason I initially focused in on Ben was Ben, of all the founding fathers, probably left behind more handholds of how he viewed the world around him and how he viewed America in its early stages. And one of the ways he did that was through Poor Richard's almanacs, which he published for 25 years. In those almanacs, there was numbers of truisms, and a lot of these we grew up with. A penny saved is a penny earned. But there's another 1,000 that really give you insights into how Ben Franklin thought that we are not really particularly aware of. Numbers of them deal with politics and government. For instance, to serve the country well and to please all of the citizens is impossible, which perhaps we might touch on this a little later, is part of our problem now where we're trying to respond to everybody's concerns. And another issue with Ben is the man suffered from the gout. And you say, okay, now how does this give us an insight into him? He had a difficult time standing in the last 20 years of his life. So he wrote down what he wanted to, the messages that he wanted to convey, and other people read these messages. So more than any other founding fathers, we have a written record of his speeches. And obviously, it would be presumptuous of anyone to speak on behalf of a founding father. What I attempted to do, and I think it has worked reasonably well, is take various sayings, various speeches that were relevant to the day and overlay them on today's events. And what you see, Greg, is really nothing has changed in the world. There are the same issues, whether it be industry, frugality, bias, prejudices, concerns that we have today that we had 200 and some years ago.
Before we really dig into your book and some of what we find there, I wonder if you could explain a little further for the sake of our listeners who, as you kind of touched on early on, very likely have only the roughest and vaguest sort of notion of exactly what Benjamin Franklin did. Maybe you could explain that just a little bit further.
I'd be glad to. And one of the advantages of Ben Franklin in choosing him as a spokesman from the past is many of the founding fathers came from money. They were, in today's terminology, elitist. They were born into wealth. Ben Franklin was sort of a Joe the plumber who became a New York Times editor. At 10 years old, growing up in Boston, he quit school and started working full-time for his father, boiling animal fat, making candles. At 12, he became an apprentice printer in Boston, struck off on his own to Philadelphia, went to England for a couple of years to enhance his trade, came back at 18, started his own printing shop in Philadelphia. By the time he was 23, he was publishing the Pennsylvania Gazette. His hallmark during his first years were frugality and hard work. So by the time he was 40, he could retire. And he did not retire and move to the south of Florida. He became a community organizer. He started the first hospital in Philadelphia, the first library, post office, fire department. He branched off into science, electricity, battery, When he was bored going across the Atlantic Ocean on one of his trips to England, he chartered the Gulf Current. But with the development of the Thomas Paine's common sense and a groundswell of perhaps this country should be independent and have democracy, Ben Franklin became involved as a founding father and was right there in Philadelphia drafting the Declaration of Independence with Thomas Jefferson, went off to France as our ambassador to France, secured loans to finance our war, secured safe harbors for our boats, negotiated the treaty with Great Britain that ended the war in the 1780s, came back, sat at the Constitutional Convention, and helped draft our Constitution, served as governor of Pennsylvania, and continued to write as a philosopher. So the man touched on any numbers of technical areas and was at the pivot point of this country in many, many situations. And one of the things that struck me is you could almost take 1 or 2 years out of Ben's adult life, and it would be the successful career for any other adult, whether it be an ambassador, a scientist, a businessman, a civil servant. The man had immense energy and breadth of interest. But I think also what made him remarkable is because of his humble background, he always spoke to the common man as the common man and could distill very complex issues into a few simple sentences.
Can you explain how he was regarded, first of all, by the general public and then by his founding fathers? And I ask that as thinking or mindful of the fact that Benjamin Franklin was obviously such an original sort of thinker and expressed himself in such intriguing ways, which, of course, is one of the reasons why he resonates so powerfully for us today and just seems like he speaks with such insight and also, of course, with this wonderful light touch. But in the eyes particularly of his fellow founding fathers, as it were, did they regard him as something of a lightweight? Or, I mean, were they perplexed or bemused by who he was?
I think just the reverse, perhaps a heavyweight. And I think maybe a first data point to use as background for this conversation is many of the founding fathers in July of 1776 were in their 30s and 40s. And as Ben Franklin said at the time, he was older than most folks sleeping in the Philadelphia graveyard. He was 70 years old when the Declaration of Independence was signed, and twice as old as most of his peers. So there was this notion of a fatherly figure. Because he had been so successful in the academic arena in his second or third career as became a scientist, he had numbers of honorary degrees from Harvard, Yale, Oxford, Cambridge. And because of that, he was addressed quite often as Dr. Franklin. He did not like public speaking, so he was considered to be somewhat of a quiet man, and the notion of still waters run deep was applied to Ben Franklin. So to answer your question, I think he was, for the most part, extremely highly regarded. I think they looked at Ben Franklin as sitting on the side, taking in various perspectives and positions, trying to distill them and come up with a solution to an approach. And some of his most poignant comments were at the end of the Constitutional Convention, where he basically said, you know, I'm not sure that I agree with this Constitution as it is written, but I don't think I ever could. And I am setting aside my self-interest and the self-interest of my state to do what I think is best for the country, and I would ask that you consider doing the same. So he was a mediator and a fatherly figure, I think, to most of the founding fathers.
We're speaking with Tom Blair, and we're talking about his new book, which is called Poorer Richard's America, What Would Ben Say? Which, by the way, has done very, very well in just this little while that it has been released. It is already a New York Times bestseller. What do you think that says, the fact that so many people seem eager to grab this book off the shelf?
I think it's a couple things. One, the book does not not state a position. It's not conservative. It's not liberal. It's not Democrat. It's not Republican. It's not Tea Party. It's an American book. And Ben is not judgmental. He has concerns in this book. And he sort of slaps us a couple times in our face in this book, but at the end, he pats us on the back. So the book is not a concern book, and it's not a demonizing book. It's we have some issues. We've had bigger issues before. If you folks face these issues, you can overcome these issues. And most of the issues concern the national deficit. They concern the notion of really citizenship in this country. And to digress for a second, I think most folks in this country would argue that America is still the greatest country. Ergo, if I'm a citizen of America, I must be one of the greatest citizens of this planet. Well, I would argue, as Ben argues in his book, that if you win the lottery, you're not particularly smart or clever, you're just lucky. In point of fact, most American citizens didn't swim here or come over on a sailing ship. They were born here, right place, right time. And that's not to hold it against them, but the fact that we're an American citizen in the greatest country perhaps has a little bit of luck versus anything else. And one of the messages Ben tries to convey in this book is there is an obligation for us to continue to carry this country forward as the greatest country, and not to look at this country as a safety net, something that will take care of us, but rather look at this country as a trampoline that allows us to jump higher and higher.
Explain how you actually put this book together and the various questions or facets of modern life that you chose to undertake and to analyze. Using the voice of Benjamin Franklin. I mean, did you just sort of sit on your patio and ponder, you know, what was sort of most on your mind, or was it a more methodical sort of undertaking than that?
I'm not sure. It was either a patio or a bar. I can't recall which I was sitting pondering this at. All kidding aside, the nice thing about Ben Franklin, again, in his Poor Richard's America, he spoke to any numbers of subjects. And for instance, today we have a controversy over religion, you know, which is the right religion, which is the wrong religion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Ben Franklin, a few months before he died, was asked by the president of Yale, do you accept Jesus as your savior? And Ben's answer back, I thought, was rather interesting, which was basically, obviously, Jesus as a man set wonderful moral standards for this country and mankind. However, in terms of whether Christianity is the correct religion or another religion is the correct religion, I'll just wait until I die to figure this out. And basically what he was saying is any religion that preaches that man should be beneficial to all of mankind is the correct religion. And I think that's a notion that plays well in today's world. He spoke of prejudice, and he spoke about the fact is a young person, he owns, when I say young person, 30s, he owned slaves. He ran ads for the sale of slaves in the Pennsylvania Gazette. But in his 60s and 70s, he wrote that he realized that he was, in fact, prejudiced, that the black race was as intellectually agile as the white race. And he devoted a fair amount of effort and energies in the last few years of his life to do away with slavery. So, again, there's any numbers of subjects that you can touch on, whether it be frugality, religion, prejudice, marriage. One of his great lines of marriage is, before marriage, keep your eyes wide open. After marriage, you need to keep them half shut. His essays on leadership, the written word, and prejudice. And in this book, we talk about bias in the press. And one of the things that Ben Franklin was very proud of in the Pennsylvania Gazette, that he was the publisher, he was adamant in not putting anything in the paper that was slanderous or not based on fact. And as he looks at today's media, he's concerned that sometimes those that report the news don't straddle the issue, but they tend to perhaps kick it to one side. And Ben offers in this book that if by chance some of today's news personalities were to become a judge, they might sentence the accused before the jury verdict. So, again, within Ben's writings, he has touched on literally every topical subject with exception of one in the United States today. And as a side, that one is the same-sex marriage, which is probably the only subject of today's world that he has not addressed in his lifetime.
One of the intriguing challenges is for you to look at what he said then about a given topic, and then, I assume, really try to discern what he would say today. I mean, because the issue might, at its essence, be the same, but there might be all kinds of specifics about it that, really render it a different sort of problem. How challenging was that for you?
In certain areas, it was challenging. In most, it wasn't. I mean, if you just think of politics, you know, he jokingly would talk about people in office and use quotes like "great talkers, little doers," "half a truth is a great lie," "mend your own faults before you point at mine," "a flood of words, a drop of reason." I think a lot of us would say, gee, that sounds perhaps like certain members of Congress that we see today. Where there was an absolute disconnect in terms of trying to overlay his thoughts on today is the national deficit. He spent the better part of half a year in England getting the Stamp Act repealed to take away the tax that was being levied on the colonies. The federal income tax and the notion of a large federal budget was something that was not in his lifetime. It was the 16th Amendment in 1913 that put in the federal tax. So if you were to address Ben Franklin right now and say, you know, we have a budget of $1.3 trillion deficit each year, he would say, okay, now what exactly budget are we talking about? How are we raising money? And why do we need to raise that money? And I think his initial reaction would be, why do we have such a large federal budget? But then you would branch yourself into, well, actually, we have airplanes that fly around, and we have this air traffic control system. Actually, we have any numbers of medications, so we have a Food and Drug Administration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there would be a year of advising Ben as to developments over the last couple hundred years before he could address some of the issues that were not typical in his lifetime.
One thing that is, I think, so intriguing is that when we read about the very earliest days of our country, so often the closer you look, the more amazing it is that we're still here, or I mean that there is a United States of America here. I mean, in contrast to what is sometimes the tendency for us to view the Founding Fathers and what they did in terms that are maybe a bit too exalted for what the reality, in fact, was. I wonder if you could just say a word about that, because you said earlier that as you looked even closer at Mr. Franklin, your admiration only grew. And when we look at certain figures from this period and what they did, sometimes just the opposite occurs.
No, it does. I mean, these folks had, you know, feet of clay. And you could take any one of them, as numbers of people have done, and written several books on, you know, why they were less than perfect. But in point of fact, America is where it is because I think they took the step. You know, they held the hands. Circumstances were such that the people were ready to move forward and try a new form of government. And I think, you know, to a certain extent, it's what made America. I mean, America has a biased selection process in the early going. America was populated by people that said, I'm willing to get on a wooden boat and go across an ocean, and I think I'll have enough energy and initiative to raise crops so the family won't starve, to slay enough deer so we can eat. And I think that biased selection process is where the Founding Fathers came from. So there was this, and I hate to use the term ego, but we can do this. You know, we can have our own government, we can have our own flag, and we can fight Britain and be independent. I think sometimes we do lose track of some of the fault. And as you get into Ben Franklin, he's like the rest of the planet. He had a couple of flat spots, I think, that people have written about. If you look at his family life, it was less than perfect. If the outcome of your children is your hallmark of success, he had a couple failures with his offspring. But nevertheless, you look at the end point, and I would have to say it's the greatest country, and we owe it to the founding fathers. Hmm.
I especially enjoy chapter 16 of your book. The heading is Information Caressed is Knowledge, Information Churned is Clutter. And I don't know if those are your words or Mr. Franklin's, but they ring very true, as do most of the observations in this brief chapter on the way in which we exchange information and receive it at such a frantic pace. And you and seemingly he expressed some grave misgivings about this.
Well, yes, and if one of Ben Franklin's most prized possessions as a very young man was the first book, used book, he was able to purchase that he read and reread. And then he took that book and sold it to purchase another book. And one of the things that Ben points out is that, you know, perched on our desk or nestled in our waistcoat pocket, we have this marvelous electronic machine that gives us all the information of his world and our world at our beck and call. But he says, Do you use this information and do you savor this information to better yourself, or do you task these amazing electronic devices with the nonsensical, exchanging numbers of emails that in themselves create a problem? And that problem being, quite often in today's world, I think Americans look at how quickly they can respond to a question as a mark of intelligence, as contrasted to how well they respond. And one of the things that Ben points out is when he was representing the colonies in England before the Declaration of Independence was declared, if he wanted advice on a subject, he would carefully write out a letter, it would be posted to the colonies, and 6 months later he would get a response. And the notion being that in his day, a missive, a correspondence, was written to see how much it could obtain and how little it could offend. And it also, because it was a deliberate process, if there was a motion involved, you could write the letter and withdraw it. Where in today's world, with instantaneous messages, we tend not to dwell on the most perfect way of sending a message, but rather the quickest way of sending the message.
And I love this observation. You friends are minutes from message sent and response received. Amazing, wonderful. But many of life's events are best played as a game of chess, not handball. I think that's really interesting, as is another observation earlier in the chapter. Other than conversation of person to person or person to persons, communication of my day was as a stalk of corn growing. And it makes us think about some of these ways in which our intercourse, our interchange with each other has changed so dramatically. And we don't often stop to think about the consequences in terms of how we regard one another and how we think about one another.
And one of the points we made in the book is he wrote a very damning piece of correspondence to a member of parliament about bloodshed in the colonies. And that letter is in the record, but by the way, he's very proud of the fact that he never posted the letter, that he had the advantage of venting his emotion, but he did not destroy a relationship. And when we push send on a computer, it does away with that option.
A lot to think about in this really interesting book called Poorer Richards America, What Would Ben Say?, which include all kinds of wonderful sayings from this great original thinker, including lines like this: "Beware of the little expenses. Small leaks will sink the greatest ships." And on and on the wisdom of Benjamin Franklin goes. The book again is called Poorer Richards America, What Would Ben Say?, published by Skyhorse. Its author, Tom Blair. Tom Blair, I so enjoyed your book and our conversation. Thank you for both.
Thank you for having me.
And tomorrow on the morning show, it's a conversation with Katie Workman about an intriguing cookbook she's written called Dinner Solved. And on Friday, my interview with Buzz Bissinger about his blockbuster bestseller of 25 years ago, Friday Night Lights. Support for the morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Cloudy and mild today with a high of only 69 degrees, overnight low of 51.